Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a philosophy that, well, it gets a bad rap sometimes. Often gets boiled down to stereotypes, you know.
Oh, yeah. The black turtlenecks, the gloomy cafes, endless despair.
Exactly. We're talking about existentialism.
But that whole caricature is precisely what we need to sort of push past. Because when you actually dig into it, existentialism isn't really about hopelessness at all.
Right.
It's arguably one of the most radical philosophies of self-creation, real empowerment. It's all about taking ownership.
Okay, that sounds way more appealing than just, you know, staring into the void. So our guide for this is Thomas Flynn's fantastic book, Existentialism, a very short introduction.
Mm-hmm.
And our goal today is to show that behind the, let's face it, sometimes heavy jargon.
Definitely some jargon, yeah.
The core message is actually pretty straightforward and honestly revolutionary.
Yeah.
You are much freer than you probably think.
And that's why it's so relevant, especially now. I mean, think about it. A lot of the old rules, the traditional ways of finding meaning, whether religious or societal, they don't hold the same power for everyone anymore.
True.
So we're left with this big question. How do we figure out what matters? How do we create meaning for ourselves? Flynn's book shows how the existentialists wrestled with exactly that. It's a very 21st century problem, really.
So to help us navigate these thinkers, and they are diverse, you know, from Kierkegaard and Nietzsche right up to Sartre. Mm. We need someone who really knows their stuff.
And Thomas Flynn is definitely that person. He's the Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor of Philosophy Emeritus at Emory University.
His specialty is 19th and 20th century continental philosophy, especially the French thinkers like Jean-Paul Sartre.
Yeah, but what makes Flynn, I think, particularly good for this kind of deep dive is not just his academic chops. It's his skill as a teacher, a pedagogue.
Right.
He spent his career taking really complex, often intimidating ideas from people like Sartre or Foucault and making them understandable. He builds bridges.
So he doesn't just give you the facts, he connects the dots.
Exactly. And he gives a balanced view, too. He covers both the atheistic side, you know, Sartre and Camus, and the theistic side, like Kierkegaard or Gabriel Marcel. You get the whole landscape.
Okay, so let's dive in. The absolute core idea, the phrase that kind of unites this whole family of thinkers is...
Existence precedes essence.
Right, that's the big one.
It really is. It flips everything on its head. Flynn uses that classic analogy, the paper knife.
Ah, yes, the paper knife. Explain that.
Okay, so if you want to make a paper knife... what comes first? The idea, right? The blueprint in the designer's mind, its purpose, its essence to cut paper exists before the actual physical knife comes into existence.
Makes sense. The concept defines the object.
Precisely. The object is made for a purpose. Now, for centuries, philosophy, especially religious thinking, kind of assumed humans worked the same way.
That we had a predefined purpose,
yeah,
like a soul. Or a fixed human nature given by God.
Exactly. An essence given before our existence. Mm. Existentialism just says, no, fundamentally no. We are, in their terms, thrown into the world. We just exist first, period.
Sure.
Yeah. And only after that, through every single choice we make, every action we take, every value we commit to, that's how we define who we are. We create our own essence through living.
Wow. Okay, so that's... incredibly freeing on one hand.
Totally.
But also kind of terrifying. If there's no pre-written script, no divine instructions, then I have to write the whole play myself.
That's it. That's the burden, but it's also the glory of it. Flynn traces this idea's development beautifully. From the 19th century thinkers like Kierkegaard wrestling with faith and doubt, or Nietzsche talking about the death of God,
yeah,
all the way to the post-World War II generation. People like Simone de Beauvoir, Albert Camus, they took these concepts and applied them to the huge ethical and political questions of their time. It's a philosophy that really emerged from confronting this absolute freedom, even when people try to run away from it.
Okay, so if freedom is absolute, the starting point, how do we handle it? Flynn breaks down some key terms here. Freedom, facticity, and transcendence.
Right, so freedom is the baseline. But it's not freedom in a vacuum. There are constraints. That's where facticity comes in.
Facticity.
What's that exactly?
It's all the stuff about you, about your situation, that you just can't change. The given facts, your past choices, your body, the specific time and place you were born into, your history.
So like the things on my resume I can't erase?
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, your past jobs, your education, maybe past mistakes. That's your facticity. It's fixed. It happened.
But then there's transcendence. That sounds like going beyond.
Exactly. Transcendence is your power to go beyond those fixed facts, to define yourself in relation to them, to give them meaning moving forward. You can't change the fact that you had a certain job, but you can choose what that experience means for you now and who you choose to be next.
So it's this constant back and forth between the unchangeable past and the potential future.
Yes. It's a dynamic, the static what is or what was, and the active what I will make of it.
And if you deny that active part, if you pretend you're just the sum of your past, just your facticity, that's when you fall into, what's the term?
Bad faith. Or mauvaise foi in French.
Bad faith. Sounds serious.
It is, ethically speaking. It's basically self-deception. It's pretending you're not free when you actually are. It's choosing to see yourself as an object, a thing, rather than a free subject.
Why would anyone do that?
Well, it's comforting, isn't it? It lets you off the hook, takes away the weight of responsibility. Sartre's famous example is the waiter.
Right, the one who's too much of a waiter.
Exactly. He performs waiterness with exaggerated precision. Sartre says he's trying to convince himself and others that he is just a waiter, defined entirely by his role, rather than a free individual who chooses to act as a waiter right now.
Okay, I see that. It's like when someone says, oh, I can't help it, I'm just a procrastinator, or that's just how I am.
Spot on. That's classic bad faith. You're treating a pattern of choices as if it's some fixed, unchangeable essence, denying your freedom to choose differently in this moment.
But as you said, this freedom isn't easy. Flynn points out that fully realizing this total freedom brings on some pretty intense, unavoidable emotions.
Yeah, it's not a comfortable realization. There's this sort of triad of feelings that come with it.
Okay, let's break those down. First one, anguish or angst. Why anguish? Freedom sounds good.
It's not just general anxiety. Anguish, for the existentialists, is the specific feeling you get when you realize the sheer scale of your responsibility. When you make a choice, say, you choose to value courage. You're not just choosing for yourself.
Would you?
You're implicitly saying courage is a value for humanity. You're proposing a model for everyone. You're basically legislating for humankind with every significant choice. That realization, that weight, that's anguish.
Oh, okay. That's heavy. And that connects to the next feeling, forlornness, abandonment.
Right. If there's no God, no pre-written moral code, no cosmic rule book, then we're abandoned to figure it out ourselves. We're alone in making these value judgments.
So it's not just feeling lonely. It's like cosmic loneliness.
Yeah.
No higher authority to appeal to.
Exactly. The buck stops entirely with you. There's no one else to blame or to give you the definitive answer. That's forlornness.
And the third one is despair. Now, this one really sounds negative. We need to be careful here.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean hopelessness.
Absolutely not. This is crucial. Existentialist despair is almost the opposite of giving up. It's about recognizing the real limits of your control.
Okay.
You can't control other people's choices. You can't control external events, luck, the universe. Despair is acknowledging that, accepting those limits, and then focusing all your energy, all your action, only on what is within your power.
Which is?
Your will. Your choices, your actions, your commitments. It's actually a very focused, very pragmatic, almost stoic kind of outlook. Act where you can act and don't waste energy on what's beyond your reach.
That makes sense. It's realism, not pessimism.
Precisely.
Flynn also points out something interesting, how linked this philosophy is to literature. Camus, Sartre, Beauvoir. They were novelists and playwrights too.
Yeah, that's not an accident. These ideas about freedom, choice, anxiety, meaning, they're about lived experience. And sometimes stories, characters, and concrete situations capture that lived reality better than abstract philosophical arguments.
And Camus is a prime example with his idea of the absurd hero, right?
Definitely. For Camus, the absurd is this clash, this unbridgeable gap between our innate human longing for meaning, order, and purpose.
And the universe's complete silence on the matter. It offers none.
Exactly. The universe just doesn't care about our need for meaning. That clash is the absurd.
So what's the response? Just give up.
No, that's the key. The response isn't suicide or blind hope. It's revolt, freedom, and passion. You revolt by refusing to be crushed by the meaninglessness. You live passionately despite the silence.
You create your own meaning in the face of it.
Yes. And the ultimate image for this is Sisyphus.
The guy pushing the rock uphill forever.
Right. Condemned to this pointless task. But Camus famously says, one must imagine Sisyphus happy.
Happy.
Because in the moment, Sisyphus fully accepts his fate. takes ownership of his rock, his struggle. It ceases to be a punishment imposed from outside. It becomes his project. He finds meaning in the struggle itself, in the defiance. He's exercising his freedom, even in that constraint.
He's transcending his facticity, even there.
You got it.
Okay, so if we pull these threads together, what are the big takeaways, the core messages Flynn leaves us with for, you know, everyday life?
I think there are three huge ones. First, the big one we started with. Existence precedes essence.
Meaning?
Meaning you are not defined by your past or by what other people expect you to be. Every moment is a new starting point. You are constantly creating yourself. So the reflection is, stop letting past failures or labels box you in. You're always an open project.
I like that. Open project. Second takeaway.
Authenticity is a choice. This is the main ethical challenge. It's about accepting that burden of freedom and responsibility we talked about.
So authenticity isn't finding some fixed true self.
No, it's about consistently choosing your values and then acting in line with them, even when it's hard. It's the opposite of bad faith, the opposite of making excuses or just conforming.
Okay. And the third key message.
Meaning, must be built, not found. The universe isn't going to hand you a purpose on a silver platter.
You have to make it yourself.
Exactly. Meaning comes from engagement, from commitment, through loving, through working on things that matter to you, through creating, through fighting for justice. It arises from doing, not just thinking or waiting for inspiration.
This philosophy definitely produced some powerful, really memorable lines of thought. Flynn highlights a few key quotes or ideas that just stick with you.
Oh, absolutely. They pack a punch. The first, we have to repeat it. Existence precedes essence. It's significance. It basically inverts millennia of philosophy. It puts the responsibility and the potential glory for defining what it means to be human squarely on us, the individuals.
Huge shift. Then there's Sartre's line, man is condemned to be free.
Yeah, that word condemned is chilling, isn't it?
It really is.
It means freedom isn't a pleasant option we can take or leave. It's an inescapable condition, a profound, sometimes terrifying responsibility we can't opt out of. You're even responsible for the ways you try to avoid responsibility.
There's no escape.
None. And the third one, incredibly influential, from Simone de Beauvoir. One is not born, but rather becomes a woman.
How does that fit in?
It's a direct application of existence precedes essence to gender and social roles. De Beauvoir argued that woman, as a social category with all its expectations and limitations, isn't a biological destiny. It's something constructed, performed, become.
So identity itself is a kind of chosen act.
Yes, but one that often happens under immense social pressure and within oppressive structures that try to deny that freedom. It turned existentialism into a powerful tool for social critique, especially feminist critique.
Okay, let's make this really practical. How can we use these ideas day to day? Think about work, for instance.
Right. That bad faith versus authenticity idea is really useful here. Ask yourself, are you just going through the motions at work, conforming to some corporate persona, playing a role, maybe feeling resentful, but blaming the system?
Yeah, feeling like a cog in the machine.
That's leaning towards bad faith. The authentic approach, which is harder, involves consciously choosing what you value in your work, trying to align your actions with those values, and taking ownership of your choices within that job, even with its constraints. It's shifting from my job defines me to I choose how I engage with this job based on my values.
That reframes things quite a bit. What about dealing with, say, anxiety, that feeling of angst we talked about?
Existentialism offers a powerful reframe here. Instead of seeing that deep, sometimes objectless anxiety purely as a mental health problem to be eliminated,
which is often the goal.
Right. It suggests that maybe some of that anxiety is actually the unavoidable emotional echo of understanding your own freedom and responsibility. It's not necessarily a sign something's wrong. It might be a sign you're waking up to your condition.
So acknowledge it. Don't just pathologize it.
Exactly. And then it directs you back to that idea of despair. Focus on what you can control, your response, your choices, your actions, rather than getting paralyzed by the vastness of what you can't control. You know, Viktor Frankl's work on finding meaning, even in concentration camps, connects deeply here.
That makes a lot of sense. Focus on the response.
And there's a social dimension, too. Remember the idea that when you choose for yourself, you choose for all humanity.
Yes. The weight of anguish.
Well, flip that around. If freedom is the fundamental value you're asserting for yourself, it implies a moral duty to fight for the freedom of others to also define themselves. It provides a strong basis for social justice, for fighting against oppression that tries to lock people into fixed roles or limit their choices.
So individual freedom actually demands social responsibility.
Absolutely. They're two sides of the same coin in existential thought.
You know, digging into Flynn's book, what surprised me most was just how relevant this all feels.
Mm-hmm.
You think of it as this mid-20th century thing born out of war and crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But its core message about radical ownership, about resisting easy definitions, it feels like exactly what we need in an age dominated by, I don't know, algorithms trying to define us, endless distractions, and maybe a tendency to look for external validation.
I completely agree. That's the lasting power of it, I think. The ultimate takeaway, the real provocation, is that fundamental shift in perspective. Are you seeing yourself as basically a product of your circumstances, your biology, your society, the data collected about you?
Yeah.
Or are you embracing the challenge of being the creator of your own meaning, your own values, your own world within those circumstances? In our age, where technology and data analytics seem to want to predict and shape our choices constantly, the existentialist challenge is more vital than ever. How much bad faith are we slipping into by letting external forces define us instead of seizing that, yes, terrifying but also glorious freedom?
A powerful question to leave us with. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.